In his novel Oil, the radical American novelist Upton Sinclair describes the effect of the Russian Revolution internationally. He said, "Just now, the radicals were in a fever over the Russian Revolution, a colossal event that had shaken the labour movement of the whole world. Here, for the first time in history, the workers had got possession of a government. And what were they making of the chance? The capitalist press of the world was, of course, portraying Russia as a nightmare. But the Soviets continued to survive, and every day of survival was a fresh defeat for the newspaper campaign. The workers could run a government. The workers were running a government. Just look." Now, I think that it's no surprise that people around the world were inspired. Here, for the first time in history, the working class were in the saddle, collectively making decisions about the running of their own world through their own democratic institutions. And what decisions? The new workers' government established workers' control of the factories and distributed land to the peasantry. It legalised divorce and abortion and decriminalised homosexuality. It initiated mass literacy campaigns and began producing cheap editions of great Russian literature. It withdrew Russia from the barbarism of the First World War. Yet the picture that we have of the supposedly communist Russia could not be further from this dazzlingly bright picture of optimism and opportunity. In just a decade, all of this was lost to the grey and bleak portrait of Stalinism, a system of gulags, political show trials, ration queues, and repression. So how can we explain such a massive shift? Now, I'll be arguing today that it's entirely insufficient to repeat in the glib words of high school teachers that Lenin led to Stalin. In fact, such statements tell us absolutely nothing about history and do not advance our understanding of what actually happened in Russia at all. In order to understand what happened in Russia, we need to look firstly at the conditions that existed within the country at the time, in particular, the decimation of the working class due to foreign invasion, civil war, and economic destruction. And secondly, and even more importantly, we need to look at the international context that the Russian Revolution found itself in and the failure of the working class revolution to come to fruition internationally. But before going on to that, let's first remind ourselves what it means to say that the defeat of the Russian Revolution was an historic defeat. So the promise of the Russian Revolution was immense. The mass popular sentiment of the revolution against the old ruling class and for a genuine working class democracy was clear to all. Even the Menshevik Martov, who was certainly no friend to the revolution, reluctantly admitted that before us, after all, is a victorious uprising of the working class. Almost the entire working class supports Lenin and expects its social liberation from the uprising. And it's no surprise that the Russian people were looking for fundamental change. Since the initial revolution of February 1917, which overthrew the Tsar, the provisional government had shown its true colours. It talked of ending the war, but instead escalated Russia's involvement. It proved no more able to inspire workers with confidence than it could supply them with food or respect. Promising but never delivering land to the peasants, it continually prevaricated and lost support with the biggest group in Russian society. So the Bolshevik slogan of bread, land and peace, which the majority of the Russian working class rallied around, encapsulated the very things that the provisional government proved unable to grant. And it was precisely these areas that the new Soviet government got to work on in the days immediately following the successful October Revolution. For example, the first law passed was the Decree on Peace, a call to all belligerent nations of the First World War to open negotiations for a just peace. Now, the success of the revolution proved that the working class was capable of governing. It transformed how people felt about themselves and the society that they lived in. Workers took over production at a factory level. Democratic representatives, delegates to the government and the Soviets, were completely accountable to their electors and were paid only the average worker's wage, so were not privileged above the rest of the population. Leon Trotsky, who was one of the leading figures of the revolution, as well as its most important historian, wrote, "A heavy hammer smashes glass but forges steel. The hammer of the revolution is forging the steel of the people's character." He continued, "Who will believe," wrote a Tsarist general, Zalewski, with indignation shortly after the upheaval, "that a porter or a watchman suddenly becomes a chief justice, a hospital attendant, the director of a hospital, a barber, an office holder, a corporal, a commander-in-chief, a day worker, a mayor, a locksmith, the director of a family. Who will believe it? But it had to be believed. They could do nothing else but believe it. When the corporals defeated the generals, when the mayor, the former day worker, broke the resistance to the old bureaucracy, the wagon greaser put the transportation system into order, the locksmith as director put the industrial equipment into working condition, who will believe it? Let anyone only try not to believe it." A decade after the revolution, though, there was little left of this sentiment, let alone the organs of working class democracy. By 1929, far from having control over their workplaces, workers were being hyper-exploited in order that the new Stalinist regime make up for the lack of development in the Russian economy. Far from the old organs of Soviet democracy, the new bureaucracy around Stalin had ever-increasing power. Far from being a natural product of the revolution, the only way this situation could be consolidated by Stalin was the wholesale destruction of the revolutionary remnants of the Bolshevik Party. Stalin's show trials resulted in most of the remaining old Bolsheviks, those who had been politically active in 1917, being executed, sent to gulags, or sent into exile. And so Trotsky did not exaggerate when he said, "The present purge draws between Bolshevism and Stalinism not simply a bloody line, but a whole river of blood. The annihilation of all the older generation of Bolsheviks, an important part of the middle generation which participated in the Civil War, and that part of the youth which took up most seriously the Bolshevik traditions, shows not only a political, but a thoroughly physical incompatibility between Bolshevism and Stalinism." So the rise of Stalin represented a complete break with the revolutionary tradition of Russia. He did not complete the revolution, but on the contrary, crushed it. Now, in the wake of the revolution, the Bolsheviks had the best of intentions. There was widespread commitment to the Soviets. The imagination had opened up and the possibilities presented by the revolution. But there's only so far that determination and willpower and ideas and imagination can take you when you're faced with the hardships that were presented to the Russians in the aftermath of the revolution. Determination will only get you so far when faced with the invading forces of 14 imperial armies, as the Red Army of the Russians were. Willpower can only sneer in the face of economic devastation for so long. Starvation can quickly begin to dampen the imagination. In Russia, the overwhelming and urgent priority became the withstanding of a siege imposed by the major imperialist countries around the globe under ever-narrowing constrictions. Every ounce of willpower and political consciousness was necessary to keep the workers' state from being overcome. Their choices were reduced to a choice between capitulation to the counter-revolutionary whites or defending the revolution with whatever means were at hand. And it can't be understated the lengths that the invading armies and the counter-revolutionary white armies were prepared to go to in order to stop the potential that the revolution represented. Plekhanov, a right-wing Menshevik at this time, stated of the Bolsheviks, "We must not only master, but crush this vermin, drown it in blood. That is the price of Russia's safety." And the whites certainly did do their best to drown the revolution in blood. Possibly the most graphic illustration of the brutality of the whites is their treatment of the Jews. It's estimated that the White Army's pogroms killed between 60,000 to 100,000 Jewish people. To demonstrate their handiwork, some of these soldiers took photographs, some of which still survive to this day. One photo, dated August 1919, shows Cossacks posing over a row of dead Jewish people wrapped in their prayer shawls. Now, it's not known exactly how many people died as a result of the Russian Civil War, but Richard Pipes, who's certainly no friend of the Russian Revolution, estimated that 1 million Reds were killed compared to 127 whites lost. So the Civil War exacted a terrible toll on the revolutionaries, not only from the massive loss of life, but also from the massive resources that were required to ensure that the revolution wasn't crushed. Already at the start of the Civil War, Russia was the equivalent of a third world country wrecked by the First World War. The Civil War exacerbated the economic problems of the country. With a lack of fuel, food, and raw materials, factories closed and workers starved. By 1920, industrial output was 31% that of 1913 levels, which is no mean feat when you consider that it's estimated that the average income per head in Russia in 1913, so you know before the war even started to wreck the economy, was below what the economy was in England in 1688. So that's the sort of low starting point of the economic basis of Russia that we're talking about here. So meanwhile, 40,000 Petrograd factory workers, those most committed to the success of the revolution, joined the Red Army to fight for its survival. Now, this economic devastation had very real consequences for the revolution. Firstly, as the economy continued to shrink, so too did the size of the working class. In 1917, the size of the industrial working class of Russia was over 3 million people. By 1922, just 5 years later, it numbered barely over 1 million. And as the working class declined numerically, so too did its centrality to politics. In its place, a new layer of bureaucrats was rising: public servants, technical experts, and party functionaries. And it was in this layer that Stalin was able to gain a foothold. It was this layer that was able to elevate Stalin to power as its representative. But it was by no means inevitable that this would happen. In order to explain why it did, we need to understand the international situation that the Russian Revolution found itself in. Now, Marxists have always argued that that a revolution could only be successful if it was international. And there are a number of reasons for this. Firstly, the threat of international retaliation is a constant for a workers' revolution. As we've seen in the revolutionary wave of the Middle East and North Africa this year, even the mass of the population placing their demands for basic democratic rights is often too much for the imperialist countries to countenance. So hence we've seen the implicit US support for Saudi Arabia crushing the revolutionary movement in Bahrain. So if even that, if even basic democratic rights, which you know the West is supposedly going to champion, if even that is too much for them, well, the threat of a workers' state, a state where without capitalist social relations and outside the sphere of influence for imperialism, is completely unacceptable. Firstly, because capitalist nations would not be able to exploit such a state. And secondly, the very existence of such a state potentially gives workers in other countries the uppity notion that they too could have some control over their own affairs. So the threat of international invasion always exists. But crucially, the more successful a workers' revolution is in spreading internationally, the larger the armies and resources and the greater the power of the socialist countries to combat this threat. Now, even more important than the military threat is the economic one. Capitalism is a global system in which every single country is economically dependent on others. And even in 1917, this was the case. No single country produces what it requires to sustain itself, let alone to thrive. Now, the possibility of socialism exists because we live in a world of potential abundance. There's the technical capacity and resources in this world for everyone to have an abundance of goods. Now, the only reason why this doesn't exist today is because of the profit motive of capitalism, which means that this capacity is diverted into the profit of a few rather than the needs of the majority. Now, this posed a dilemma for the workers' state. Russia was able to just hold on by the skin of its nails for a little while, but without the material help of a wealthy country, this reality of economic deprivation could not be overcome, and the conditions for socialism, that abundance of goods, did not exist. So there are two possibilities for a country that does have a workers' revolution. Either that country is part of a chain of such revolutions, and there can be the development of an international cooperative economy where goods and resources are shared for the good of all in order that that abundance can exist, or alternatively, that country is forced back into the competitive trade system of capitalism. Now, unsurprisingly, the Russian socialists preferred the first option, which is why the leaders of the Bolsheviks were so strident in arguing for international revolution. Lenin, for example, wrote, "We always staked our play upon an international revolution. In one country, it is impossible to accomplish such a work as a socialist revolution." Now, this hope in international revolution was not some naive utopianism. In fact, it was a very real possibility. Almost every single country with an industrial working class had at least some degree of radicalisation in the period immediately following the First World War. Old established monarchies were overturned, state powers shook, and in some places the question of which class was to hold power was on the cards. In Germany, between 1918 and 1921, and again in 1923, in Austria in 1918 to 1919, in Hungary, which established a Soviet government in 1919, and in Italy's so-called two red years of 1919 and 1920. Even as far afield as New York, 500 workers volunteered to join the Red Guard to defend the Soviet Union against the German invasion, while hundreds of working women threw their jewellery onto the stage to give their support to the revolution. Now, even the British Prime Minister Lloyd George was shivering in his boots at the prospect, complaining that the whole of Europe is filled with the spirit of revolution. There is a deep sense, not only of discontent, but anger and revolt amongst the workers against pre-war conditions. The whole existing order in its political, social, and economic aspects is being questioned by the masses from one end of Europe to another. Yeah. So you really get a sense of the sort of possibility that we're talking about here. But for the Russians, the great hope lay with Germany, and for good reason. From October 1918, Germany was in the midst of a revolutionary upsurge, an upsurge born of the exact same factors as that of Russia: war, hunger, poverty, and the ineptitude of the ruling class. The upsurge swept across the country, from Dusseldorf in the west to Dresden in the east, from Hamburg in the north to Munich in the south. Town after town fell to the revolution. Demonstrations and general strikes were held, and workers and sailors' councils were elected and held effective power. The revolutionary paper, Red Flag, proclaimed, "This is the beginning of the German Revolution, of the World Revolution. Hail the most powerful action of the world revolution. Long live socialism. Long live the German Workers' Republic. Long live world Bolshevism." So there was a clear revolutionary anger on the part of the German working class. But the question was, how would it be directed? As anyone who's ever been in a fight knows, it's one thing to have some anger behind your blows, but if you're just flailing around wildly without any direction of those blows, you're not going to win. And in the case of Russia, this was the role that the Bolsheviks played. They had the experience of being involved in the working class struggle over decades, the knowledge of the history of this struggle, and the authority and the respect of the working class that it could argue the way forward to victory. In Germany, though, there was no working class party with this knowledge and experience to lead the upsurge to victory. Instead, the Social Democratic Party, a moderate reformist party, took power and played a crucial role in crushing the revolution and killing its leaders. Ultimately, but only after 5 long years, the German ruling class were able to crush the workers' movement and restore capitalist order. So there was a very real possibility of a workers' revolution spreading to more industrially advanced and economically prosperous countries, which would have provided a necessary breathing space for the Russian Revolution. The defeat of the German Revolution was crucial to the fate of Russia. As I said before, Stalin was able to come to power because of the destruction of the working class due to the civil war and the devastation of the economy, precisely the two factors which could have been alleviated by a successful revolution in Germany. As Trotsky argued to those in the Bolsheviks who argued that the question was whether socialism could be built in Russia, leaving aside international affairs, the whole point is that we cannot leave them aside. You can go for a walk naked in the streets of Moscow in winter if you leave aside the weather and the militia, but I'm afraid to say neither the weather nor the militia will leave you aside. Now, just as the rise of Stalin was the repudiation of the revolution, so too was the regime that he created the repudiation of the genuine Marxist tradition. Where Marxism is for mass working class democracy, Stalin and his successors crushed any democratic movement. Where Marxism fights for the rights of the oppressed, Stalin stripped away those rights and reversed the gains of the revolution. Where Marxism is for the working class, Stalin represented the power of a new ruling elite. By 1928, Stalin was drawing a clear path for Russia. He moved to a policy which offered the elite around him the possibility of strengthening itself at home and abroad, enforced industrialization to be paid for by seizing grain, but from the peasants by force. So Stalin insisted, to slacken the pace of industrialization would mean to lag behind, and those who lag behind are beaten. We are 50 to 100 years behind the advanced countries. We must make good this lag in 10 years or they will crush us. Now, in order to make good this lag, Stalin's state enforced mass deprivation on the workers and peasants of Russia. Ultimately, the only way that Stalin's state was able to catch up with the Western economies was for the overwhelming majority of the economy to be directed towards the production of heavy industry and arms production and against workers' consumption. So production of goods for the consumption of the working class was completely subordinated to this goal. The hunger of huge numbers of workers didn't compare with the need to be able to economically compete on the world market for this so-called communist country. Although this production was under the control of the state rather than private capitalists, it still followed the same logic as that in Western capitalism. It's still produced in the interests of those at the top of society, not in the interests of the mass of the population. So it was a capitalist logic carried out under the direction of a nation state. In other words, Stalinist Russia represented a state capitalism. Now, under Stalin and his successors, the real meaning of socialism was distorted beyond recognition and used not as a guide to human liberation, but as an ideology to justify a program of accumulation on the backs of Russian workers and peasants. But once again, the rise of Stalin was a result of historic forces occurring at the time and was not inevitable. The failure to spread the revolution left Russia isolated. And it had to suffer a material blockade, as well as all the horrors of foreign invasion, civil war, devastation, disease, and hunger. As Rosa Luxemburg, a leader of the German Revolution, wrote, Everything that happens in Russia is comprehensible and represents an inevitable chain of causes and effects, the starting point and end term of which are the failure of the German working class and the occupation of Russia by German imperialism. Now, there are many who would argue that this failure means that it's futile to fight for a better world. I disagree. The fact that the logic of the capitalist system means that when it reasserts itself against its detractors, it can throw up horrors like Stalinism should surely strengthen our resolve to rid ourselves of that system. But more than this, the defeat of the Russian Revolution should also open our eyes as to what's required to be successful when our turn comes. Already this year, we've seen two revolutions successfully overthrowing entrenched dictatorships, and the working classes in Egypt and Tunisia are continuing their attempts to shape their future in those countries. Great social struggles will continue to occur, and there's no way to know what the outcomes of these struggles will be. That depends both on the relative strength of the competing social classes involved in these struggles, as well as the extent to which there emerges within the working class a core of people who understand how to fight and know how to win others to the struggle. There'll be no shortage of groups and movements in bitter opposition to one or another aspect of the system. Its very barbarity and irrationality will ensure this in the future as it has in the past. But the history of the last 100 years has shown that these elements can only be truly effective when they crystallise into revolutionary organisations that are dedicated to challenging the system in all its aspects. Now, I quoted before from Rosa Luxemburg. The quote continues as follows. She said, "Lenin and Trotsky and their friends were the first, those who went ahead as an example to the working class of the world. They are still the only ones who up to now can cry, 'I have dared.'" In Russia, the problem could only be posed. It could not be solved in Russia. And in this sense, the future everywhere belongs to Bolshevism.